Any other questions?
Quick ones. Okay, great. We'll move into the long ones.
Okay, then let's go into the long ones, or whatever else you want to ask. It can be quick, too. But because we're recording this for the world, if you do not think you project well, just walk up to the mic and ask it from there. Okay? Anyone, we can go back to it. I know you had a question. Do you mind restating it with the mic?
This is your first
test. I'm not tall enough to use the mic. So my question was for Diane. You said that you were a consultant for many years, and I was just wondering what kind of consulting you did and how that worked for you.
Yeah, I recommend reading Dan Pink, Free Agent Nation. When I was thinking about, well, how am I going to deal with my, you know, nephew, and I'm, you know, leaving this great government job that pays full time, what can I do besides adjuncting, you know? I read that book and I began to think, well, it wouldn't be bad to have my own business, and then I could set my own hours. And I had acquired a skill towards the end of my period at the agency, which was marketable. And it's basically this. You'll probably have never heard of it. There are only 80 of us who do it in the country for full-time work. And it's called graphic recording. What happened was I was really fortunate towards the end to be involved in the NIC, the National Intelligence Council's Global Trends 2020 report. Now they've just issued, I think a month ago, the 2030 report. But I was working on the 2021, on imagining the future. And I got into futurist work big time. It is so fascinating, and it's so perfect for us. You know, we study, you know, long durée, right? We understand processes of change and how sometimes they can be, you know, quite sudden, and sometimes they take a very long time. And we sort of understand how ideas spread. These are all valuable tools when you're thinking about the future as well as the past. So I was at a conference, it was a retreat, and the consultants from the Monitor Group, one of the best consultants, I think, for future work, they brought with them a graphic recorder, and for 4 days, everything we said basically was put on huge murals, either in images or in short words, in sound bites, basically, synthesizing and capturing what was spoken. And I was captivated by that, and I said that I would be willing to go out and get trained in that method and bring it inside the classified environment, and I did. And so for about a year, I was able to go into strategic planning meetings, and so that everyone could kind of see their own path, see the path that we were kind of headed towards in our visioning. And so I created, as soon as I resigned, I created an LLC called Over the Horizon Consulting LLC. There's a kind of radar that was used, it used to be very top secret, that could be seeing over the horizon to see what was coming even before those ships appear on your radar and get close enough to be, you know, a target or a so an adversary. So I created this business, and I began to attend network meetings. I just Googled online to see what was going on in my area. I went to meetings of the Chesapeake Bay Organizational Development Network, Appreciative Inquiry Circle, Capital Creativity Network, Complexity Science Monthly Talks. Just started really going out into the community. I also participated in Government 2.0 unconferences and you know, just met a lot of people and did this kind of work for free for a little while and just developed a kind of clientele who were mainly organizational development facilitators or consultants. And I worked with them, and it was just like night and day for me. I'd been in a very dark, concealed, closed place, and then I was able to just really, you know, do the same kind of work, the close listening and searching for the actionable intelligence, you know, pulling that out of people and concisely showing what it is, but I, you know, did it out in the open and in the bright big world. So I really enjoyed doing it, and it's not for everybody, but it was definitely for me.
Other questions at the moment? I have things to keep you guys talking, but I'll let you guys go first.
Yeah. I really appreciated all the talks. I teach at a
undergraduate institution, and I know this is not the main topic of a panel, but I was very touched by some of the descriptions of a training that you get as classicists and how they can apply in all sorts of new ways. Are some of the same opportunities available at for people graduating from undergraduate institutions, or do you feel like the kind of prolonged time you've had in graduate school is really the key to some of these opportunities?
I'm going to jump in here and anticipate part of what I'll be saying later. The Association of American Colleges and Universities did a series of studies over the last decade and a half of employer surveys on what the employers look for in undergraduates and in potential staff. And one of the things that stood out is the kinds of things that you would learn in studying the liberal arts, in particular, classics is one of the fields in there, is exactly what the higher order executives in national corporations are deeming important. And so it is potentially a justification for the fields and a sign of the benefit the fields can provide. It's all online, www.aacu.org, and look for the Peter Hart surveys under the Liberal Education and America's Progress LEAP initiative.
What I wanted to add was, at least for the intelligence community, they definitely recruit right out of undergrad. And if you are considering, and you're still at a university, and you're considering a move away from getting the PhD or you've just finished, if you are still on campus, you must take advantage of your university's career center because they're interviewing. Why aren't you going, right? So there are recruitment events there. There's interview opportunities. There are also often co-op or internship directors, staff members you could talk to who know thousands of employers. And you'll be unusual in that field because it is mainly for undergrads. So they're going to scoop you up. Take advantage of it. They may have unusual names. For example, at the University of Cincinnati, it might be the Center for Experiential Learning. They're the ones who do the co-ops and internships. But you wouldn't think that, right? But they're the ones who can hook you up with employers. And we also have the Center for Professional Practice, which sounds like going to the dentist or something. But those are the folks also who hook you up with jobs. And we have something called the Center for Community Engagement, which, again, doesn't sound like jobs, but they're the people who know all the nonprofits and all of the sort of idealist.org organizations and can hook you up. So take full advantage of those. Even when I was an assistant professor, I went to the Career Center to ask for help in interviewing. They'll tape you. They'll give you feedback. Do it.
No, use the
microphone.
Oh. It's just a little comment. This is why we didn't try earlier, because we didn't know what it was. Center for Experiential Learning. We just passed by and we don't know what it is.
Right. Check it out. Definitely. Experiential learning is when you're learning on the job. Job. J-O-B. Job.
Or job.
For Michelle, you said that you maintained a research schedule even as you were working at the nonprofit, and it seemed like you were extraordinarily busy. I was wondering how you went about keeping up with a research schedule like that.
Yeah, well, there were two sides of it, and it was very difficult. On the one hand, I made part of my job research by working on programs and things that interested me and that had an impact. I was able to make an argument for coming to the AIA, for instance, on WMF's dime, which I did almost every year. And I made sure I went to the cultural heritage presentations, and I was asked to be on panels from the other side of the coin of conservation and things like that. But I also would publish some things in, different types of journals or magazines and things like that. But the climate change stuff I worked on as part of the work of the World Monuments Fund. So it was part of my job. I made it part of my job because I convinced my organization that this was something that we should be doing, and in order to be credible, we had to write about it and things. But then when I did decide to try to get back into academia kind of more normally, I did kind of go home every night and on the weekends and work on my classics articles, which was harder. But it's possible to do a little bit on the job as well, and that was part of my thing.
I was able to publish a paper in 2005 while I was at the agency in CQ, Cryptologic Quarterly. And it won the National Cryptologic Literature Award for 2005 for the country, yeah. It is peer reviewed, but it's secret, so I couldn't even take a copy out. I don't have it.
No offense.
I know, that's the funny thing, but it's Cryptologic Quarterly. The other thing I would recommend, just one more thing, is to learn how to make your graduate research seem relevant to the modern day. So, for example, I said I was a Greek epigrapher. I worked on the inventory lists of the Parthenon treasures, of the treasures kept inside the temple in the 5th and 4th centuries BC. I talked about how those are related to transparency and freedom of information and accountability in a democracy. Get it? Yeah.
All right, well, I'll do one of my first questions, which is most of what you've said and the way you've said it is geared towards what it sounds like graduate students or recent graduates who are thinking about what to do next. What advice would you give, if you had 5 minutes to talk, to people who are now teaching these students on how to get them ready for this? Would you change the curriculum at all? Would you say more or less Pindar? Like, what would you say to them to get them ready for these jobs you've got?
Talking to graduate students?
No. Well, how would you tell the professors to teach the grad students, if any of
them? Oh, yes.
Well, I'll jump in here. Personally, I think it's irresponsible of any professor who's advising graduate students to not bring up the idea of alternate employment, and not just bring it up in the sense of, oh, maybe you might want to think about this, but bring it up and follow up regularly. You know, what is your other plan? What else do you have in mind if this doesn't work out? I've seen so many friends go down miserably in the job market, and it's such a demoralizing experience. It doesn't have to be like this, but you have to be paying attention along the way. And I know occasionally there's some stigma associated with, oh, people are sinking a lot of time and energy into my professional development. They're going to feel very bad, as you were mentioning. They'll feel very bad if I turn my back on them. But, you know, any professor ultimately wants to see his or her students thrive. So that would be my advice.
No. There was a paper given by Michael Berube, the president of the MLA, at the meeting of the Council of Graduate Schools in December that basically eviscerates the graduate school industry, especially in the humanities, and talks about how there needs to be a fundamental rethinking of the purpose and also of the process of graduate education. Forcing shorter degrees, supporting students as they complete degrees in a shorter time frame, multiple tracks, some of them traditional academics, some of them preparing students in the intellectual capacities of these fields that are adaptable to other areas, but not necessarily looking towards career possibilities within the fields, honoring the possibility of alternative routes to employment that have been very shallowly integrated into the humanities so far, but need to be much more deeply involved. So there is that conversation is going on nationally. It has not become part of the warp and woof of higher education yet.
I'll jump in because I have a slide about this in the deck that I have. But it seems to me that graduate departments can do three things to encourage students along alternate career paths. The model here is, you know, some of the more successfully integrated graduate programs in computer science, you know, in mathematics, in, you know, business schools. These are outreach coursework and internships. right? You know, outreach meaning, you know, to have the department reach out to the local community, because there are a lot of people, you know, like the people up here at the panel, who are interested in, you know, classical studies, but, you know, are not, you know, they don't get the lecture invitations, you know, they don't get the, they don't feel part of that community. And that's a networking opportunity for graduate students. And that's, you know, something that I think graduate departments, you know, should be participating in terms of that kind of outreach. The second thing is coursework. I mean, I don't think there's any excuse for a graduate student in, you know, archaeology to not be fully versed in Microsoft Excel or a statistical platform. And that should be part of, you know, the regular coursework that graduate programs encourage or even require. And third is internships, you know, summer internships. You know, my company does a summer internship, but we very rarely get graduate students, even though, you know, we try to, you know through networks, you know, try to get graduate students. But, you know, departments should be encouraging graduate students to participate, seek out, and apply for these summer internships to get them that experience outside of academia.
Say I'm institutionalized, you know, I still consider my laptop to be a word processor. And I was wondering if you could suggest some ideas, types of skills that we would need to get into this millennium, and kind of, you know, that these jobs we're talking about actually, you know, would like to see in us as well as, you know, what's in here.
So I'll say a couple words about software in particular, but I think the point is more generalizable than this. So in the case of software and computer technology in particular, you know, whatever your feeling are about MOOCs, this massive online courses, Stanford has led the way in putting almost all of their computer science courses online. And they're very good and of very high quality. And I routinely see people who have done nothing but follow the some of the online materials at Stanford and come in as very skilled software engineers. So that's, and I think that same pattern is starting to hold true increasingly of a lot of other materials. So I think the resources are probably out there for the taking.
I'd like to add, in the past 5 or 6 or 7 years, I found what changed my ideas radically about the processes of change in the future and in ancient Greece and Rome has been complexity science, and I encourage you to learn more about it. About seeing Greek culture, for example, as a complex adaptive system, and looking at systems thinking as well, and causal loops, and just these are approaches that are helpful in all industries, in all fields, and complexity science is the 21st century science, the science of all sciences, and I encourage you to learn more about it. Design thinking would be another thing to investigate, even if you're a dissertation topic is, you know, rather straightforward. Still, the idea, the process of design thinking helps you look at your subject fresh and learn how to do it. Yeah.